Let's give it up for Steve Bloom and the one and only Tommy Chong. Yo, give it up for Tommy. Get up for Tommy, yo. Woo! A legend right here in Eugene.
Thank you, please. Thanks for the clap. Appreciate it. Oh, I got a present for Steve. Chong's Choice. Let's smoke this now. Get that out of the way right away.
Delicious. What strain do we have here?
What does it matter? No, that's the name of it. What does it matter?
WTF. So I'm very excited to be here in Eugene at the conference here. It's just a terrific crowd. Wow, overflow. And I thank everybody for waiting for this presentation here. It's been a really great day of so much information. I've learned so much. I'm super excited to be here with one of my heroes, Tommy Chong. I used to work at High Times. I met Tommy 20 years ago or more through those circles, and we became friends. And just we keep running into each other one place or the other, and I've kept up with him. He's always been very gracious with me. He's written from my website, Celeb Stoner, appeared on the cover of High Times multiple times, has appeared at my new magazine, Freedom Leaf, and now Tommy's very busy in the marijuana business as well. So we decided to put together a nice interview, and we're going to go through Tommy's life. You're going to learn a lot of things you may not have known about what Tommy did before he even became a comedian. But I'd really like to just start by asking Tommy, how was your 420?
I don't remember. Let's see, it started off about 419.
Okay.
Then we eased into it. No, we, Cheech and I and my darling wife Shelby appeared at the Nokia, formerly the Nokia Theater in Los Angeles. We did a show, it was incredible. I got really stoned before the show, and then I rambled a bit, like I'm doing now.
You played last night as well with Cheech in San Francisco?
Last night, yeah, in San Francisco. Yeah, we played at the Fox Warfield Theater. Beautiful, beautiful little, built in 1926. Beautiful stage in the audience. There's not a bad seat in the house. And, oh, I love theaters, because people, the performer controls the room, you know, in theaters like that. And so when you do comedy, that's very important. It's like playing the finest Stradivarius violin you could play, you know, if you could play violin. And so a theater is really important to comedians, especially stoner comedians, you know.
What's it like performing with Cheech these days, all these years later? How does it go? How does the crowd respond?
It's so much fun. It is so much fun because we've changed so much. We're both old. It's like grumpy old stoners. He's writing his memoirs, and he's writing down stuff that, fuck, I don't remember doing that.
It's time for him to get back at you, right?
I don't know. No, Cheech has joined up. He's got his own strain out called Cheech's Private Stash. For real, yeah. And we're helping him with the strain.
So you're competing or you're working together?
No, he's working actually for us. We're helping. It's a funny story with Cheech because he didn't believe the pot thing was going to happen. You know, he thought he was. He smoked pot. He was like a pothead, but he was, you know, he was kind of wary about it, you know. Especially when I got busted, you know, his biggest fear was going to jail. His dad was a cop, so Cheech was like indoctrinated into that cop mentality thing. And so I went to jail. I was happy to go, man. Shit, adventure, you know. In bed with the troops, you know. And the reason I didn't mind going to jail is that I had a friend that we got into a little thing. He stole the car, and then we went on a joyride, and the car turned over in a some water, and we all survived, and it was a real good adventure, except my friend got 2 years in prison. But when he come out, man, he was all buffed, looking good, you know. And I thought, fuck, I wouldn't mind doing that. And then years later, I did it. It was a trip walking through the gates, looking at the prison, thinking, oh, shit, it happened. But it was a great experience, you know. But Cheech, he's a little, he didn't want to go to prison, you know. And we got busted one time in Tampa for obscenity. It was when Jim Morris, when he got arrested for showing his wiener on stage. And and so the hall had a $5,000 bounty. Like if you broke that rule, any, you know, obscenity rule in any way, you forfeited $5,000. But to make it real, they had to arrest you, you know, to make it like a real crime. And so Cheech and I did our act, and we got arrested. Part of the reason was that we used to do dogs. Cheech would be a dog, I'd be another dog, and we'd smell each other's butts and try to hump each other, and the whole dog thing. And I guess the cops, or someone, the hall owner thought, well, that's obscene. And so they put us in jail. And when we went to jail, at first Cheech was really funny. He was joking with the guards, you know, and making jokes, because we just got off stage, and next thing you know, we're in jail, and so we still had that comedic vibe going, you know. And the guards weren't laughing at Cheech, you know, they're just giving him that guard look, you know, because to him, you know, Cheech is just another Mexican, you know, that got caught with drugs or something. So one time, this big redneck guard goes walking by, and Cheech goes, jail tendy, can I get some pink toilet paper? And the guard looked, just give him a look, you know, like, I'm going to remember you. And so then we thought we were going to be there for like, you know, half hour. 6 hours later, we're sitting there looking at each other. And so then it was time for them to split us up. You know, now like it looked like we were going to stay the night. And so they took Cheech all by himself. That's when Cheech changed from being a comedian to being a very scared little fucker. A Mexican that's in a jail with a big redneck cop and going up an elevator. The Cheech's demeanor changed quite a bit. He told me, he said, yeah. First thing he said when he got in the elevator, you know, my dad's a cop. LAPD, yeah, 30 years, sergeant. So Cheech was always a little scared a bit about being arrested. I was on the other, I loved it. I loved the adventure. I loved the people. Because I'm a people person, I study everybody, and everybody's got a story, you know. And if you're a movie maker like I am, you want to hear that story, because you never know what you can use. So, like now.
All right, so we'll get back to talking a little bit more about Cheech in a minute, but we're going to go back in time a little bit and flash back to Tommy being born on May 24th, 1938 in Edmonton, Alberta, and he was raised in Calgary. So what was it like growing up for you in Western Canada?
It was interesting. It was fun, you know. It was... There's a John Steinbeck, Grapes of Wrath, you know, the 30s, the Depression, the Dust Bowl, and the wagons. Yeah. My earliest, well, my mother told me when I was born, my dad had got some homestead north of Edmonton, and he got it for a good price, I guess. And he was quite young. And so they moved out there, and there was no no structure. There, the only thing was livable was a chicken coop. And so my first memory, I don't remember being in it, but my mother, you know, and my dad, they cleaned out this chicken coop and made a home. And that's where we lived for a few months of my life. And then we had to move into Edmonton. I think my dad joined the army. And so moving from the chicken coop into Edmonton, this is my mother telling me this, that we were on a horse-drawn wagon with all our furniture and everything on the wagon, and we were riding on top of the in the back, and we had a pet crow. My mother was very good with animals, and she had a pet crow. And then we lost the crow on the way to Edmonton on the wagon. And my mother, she was a great storyteller. She's Irish, Scotch-Irish. And so she would tell me all these great stories about my early baby life, you know, my whole life. And my mother was very special, very beautiful. She was 5'8", dark haired, just gorgeous. She came from a family of like 11 brothers and sisters. And she was the prettiest of them all. And then she got TB when she was in her 20s. I was about 4, I guess. And then she got TB, and so she was put in a sanitarium. And my brother and I were put in a home because my dad had some medical issues from the army. And so I ended up in the hospital because they did an x-ray and found out that I had pleurisy. And so the whole family ended up in the hospital. And that's where I kind of got institutionalized, you know, right from early birth. And then I went from the hospital into a home, an orphanage, a Salvation Army home. And my brother was there. He was 2.5 years older than me. And so he was going to school. And so he had to go through that whole rough being a minority, being teased, not only a minority, but a kid from the home. And the schools, they went to public school, but the school would embarrass the kids by telling the home kids, please stand, and the home kids would have to stand, and then the teacher would give them a pint of milk free, you know, from the government. And my brother had to endure that. And so he learned how to fight real easy, real early in his life, fist fight. And he was very tough kid. And I was the opposite. I was very experimental. Like, I learned about electricity. We never lived, our house never had electricity, so I didn't know anything about electricity. Because we lived with a kerosene lamp and a wood stove. And so when I was in the home, I found out that if you stick a needle into a wall socket, you get a shock. And it'll hurt. That was my first thing about electricity. And my sister, we had a baby sister too. She was in the home too. And she was so beautiful because she was mixed. Like, you know, we were all mixed, we were brown, but she was especially beautiful. So she was so beautiful that the newspaper took pictures of her and being a tub and showing the home kids, you know, and she was the one that they used, my younger sister. And my brother, I would see him periodically during the day sometimes, and sometimes we'd go days without seeing him, seeing each other. But he always protected me, he kept me, you know, under his wing. And then we moved, after the home, we moved into the another house with no electricity, no indoor plumbing, outdoor plumbing, the outhouse. And that's where I grew up. That was my earliest, I guess age 6 to 13. I grew up like in that environment. And that's where I learned, you know, how to love nature, because, you know, there were no parks, there was just the fields, and the fields were just filled with everything any kid would need. And then if you walked across this field, there would be a little foothills with some poplar trees growing. And that was the only tree that we could see about a mile from our house. When I was a kid, I used to, my mother would pack a lunch for me, and I'd go off on a hike to the groves and climb the trees and just play in nature. And nature is so beautiful. You learn so much. And that's the way I grew up.
So you got into music at a young age, right?
Same age. There was a fiddle player that lived across the field from us. And my mother had a, when she was carrying me as a baby, she bought a guitar. And she used to hold it against her stomach and strum it. She couldn't play it, but she'd just strum the guitar. And she never learned to play, but... And so when I got around 10 years old, I picked up this guitar and I started playing, learned how to play it. I really wanted to play the fiddle, but and my dad and my mom, they bought me a fiddle, but I couldn't tune it. But I could tune the guitar, so I ended up playing guitar with the fiddle player that lived across the ways. So I was 10 years old, and I was sitting and playing all night party, a dance party, and it was... That's where I learned the basic music, you know. He taught me two things. He said, keep it simple and give the people what they want. That works for everything.
We're looking at a photo of a band called the Calgary Shades. This is Tommy in the photo. That's him at the right wearing the shades, of course. So right around that time is when you first smoked marijuana, right? Tell me about your first joint.
Oh, yeah. Well, I was playing music with the band, you know, so... But it was funny. We were like the first punk band because none of us really knew our instrument that well, you know, like crazy good. But we all could play good enough. And I'd played with a fiddle player long enough, and I had chops, and I'd played with another Native American, Sarsi Native named Dick Bird. He was my first partner. Him and I played. He would do Elvis impersonations. He'd grease his hair back, and he had kind of acne, and he was a big guy. He didn't look at all like Elvis, but he'd put his collar up, and he'd sing, and the girls would go crazy. The whole audience, it was like the movies. And that was how I got into music. And then Dick would always get gigs for us, you know, like at the Legion Hall. We'd play just him and I. And we killed it. And then we met Tommy, the singer, the tallest guy. He was a star football player for the B team in Calgary, and he was going to be a pro. He was one of the fastest running backs Calgary had ever seen. Tommy was from a black settlement north of Edmonton. It was the settlement was started by these slaves, freed slaves from Texas. And when they were in Texas, they got together. A lot of them were related, but they got together, and they looked at the map, and they wanted to see the furthest distance from Texas that they could get. And it was Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. Mm-hmm. And so they went up to Edmonton. But the people in Edmonton, they didn't want the colored in their town. So they kept going north until they found this little, they founded a community called, what the hell? Forgot it now. Stone, sorry. But I think of it. What the hell is it here? Anyway, it was a little community and of ex-Texas slaves. And then the generation after generation, they stayed within the community. And I actually married Maxine Sneed, my first wife. She was a descendant from that area. And Floyd Sneed, you know, he's a drummer for Three Dog Night. Remember the group Three Dog Night? Well, Floyd is from that area too. He's a drummer, and he was uh, He was part of the gang. And he was also in the Shades. And so Tommy, as a star football player, he was an incredible dancer. In fact, that's how I got into dancing, because I was trying to learn how to dance, and then I met Tommy, and then my life changed, because it was all about dancing. And so we danced. Everybody else would be out fighting or getting drunk, and we'd be at some party dancing or at a club dancing. And then when we started playing music, it was just natural. At first, we had Tommy with a girl partner dance, and we'd play the Legion Hall, and Dick and I would, and Tommy would sing. But Tommy was, his job really was to dance with the girl. And then Tommy turned me on to rhythm and blues. I'd never heard of Bo Diddley before, or Chuck Berry, or Fats Waller, anybody, all the old blues guys. And then Tommy turned me on to them. They were called Race Records at that time in Canada. You couldn't buy them anywhere. And the porters on the train would bring them up from the States, and they would get into the black community, and then all of a sudden we'd have all this great music. And the white radio stations, they just played country, and they didn't know anything about the music we were playing. And so when we put a band together, that's the kind of music we played. We were like playing the Stones, Mona, and Bo Diddley, those songs way before anybody was playing. And then we not only played music, but we put on a show. Because Tommy was such a great dancer, he had a lot of moves, and then we would do moves on stage together, and then, oh, it was crazy.
Well, I asked you about your first joint, but it's sort of, but it still leads me more in the direction of your career with Motown. Maybe we can get to the first joint later, because you, most people don't know that you, about your music career. In 1966, you played guitar in the band Bobby Taylor and the Vancouvers, who eventually were signed by Motown. The band had songs on the charts, cracked the top 100 in 1968 with the song "Does Your Mama Know About Me?" What a great song.
Yeah.
Not that well known, but it's really a Motown classic. I see you almost get tears in your eyes when you hear that. What does it make you feel like when you think back to that time in your life?
Well, it was a poem first. You know, I write poetry, basically. And
did you write that song?
Yeah.
Yeah?
I wrote the lyrics and the words.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. He wrote both.
Yeah. I'm really good at that. No, I write somebody else poetry, wrote the music. And Tom Baird, he's deceased now, but he was a piano player that we would play with now and then. He looked at my poem, and he says, oh, he took it home, and he put the music to it. And it just turned out so beautiful. The bass player, Wes Henderson, and I, we wrote the bridge of that song. And we've been ripped off a few times by some other acts, you know, that stole that bridge. And they tell us, they told that it was the Doobie Brothers. You're still a young man, and there's a part in there that's where they got from "Does Your Mama Know About Me?" Mm-hmm. But yeah, it was a good song.
So Motown, I mean, you were on Motown with all these great acts. I mean, you.
Well, I was
Diana Ross. I mean, you were discovered by Diana Ross, weren't you? The band, and she came and saw you, and Berry Gordy came, and you were in the, you know, Stevie Wonder, Marvin Gaye, Michael Jackson, the Jacksons. What was that like being around all the Motown stars of that time?
Oh, it was a dream come true, you know, because when we started the Shades, you know, we would listen to we were a cover band. Everybody was a cover band. We'd listen to all these guys, you know, and then to meet them and to play with them was like, wow. Like I met B.B. King one time, and I was so in love with B.B. King and his music that was, so I met him, and I was like, and he introduced himself to me. He said, "Hi, I'm B.B. King." Cheech and I looked at each other, "Yeah, we know. You certainly are a B.B. King." And he was very humble. But the music, man, the blues, and that whole culture, you know, because I had to learn. I you know, you don't jump into a culture like that. You had to learn the language. You know, it's a total foreign language. And then you had to learn what to like and not to like, you know. And it was all about mostly music and, you know, attitude more than anything. But I learned, and then being in the minority community, you see why shit happens down there, you know, because everyday life, you know, in the ghetto can be very tense because it's hungry people looking to make a living, you know, make some money. You need some money, and you put that. You know, like you don't wear nice watches in certain areas down there, you know, because that's...
You're talking about Detroit or yeah, when you were in Michigan?
Any ghetto, any yeah. place in America.
Well, didn't you have a hand in discovering Michael Jackson?
Sure did. Sure did. We were playing at the Regal Theater in Chicago with Jerry Butler. And this group had won a high school contest. And they were called the Jackson 5 Plus Johnny. And that was their name. I don't know what happened to Johnny. Probably became their road manager. But they won a contest, and when we heard Michael sing, they did "My Girl," and oh, it was. And watch him perform on stage. I mean, it was like, you know, seeing the Dalai Lama. You know, he was a god that young, and so Bobby. Bobby Taylor is a very interesting guy. That's how I got into comedy a lot through Bobby, because Bobby really is he's like a mix between Richard Pryor and Red Fox and Chris Rock. He's all those guys, you know, the Wayans brothers. And so Bobby Taylor was such a sharp eye. And so he told the boys, the Jackson 5, he says, and their father, Joe, was with them. And he said, you know, you got to come to Detroit, stay at my house, stay at my apartment, and we'll introduce you to Berry Gordy, and you'll have a career. And that's what happened. Yeah. And the funny thing, when they got the contract, Joe Jackson brought me the contract because I was the whitest guy that he knew. "Excuse me, sir, you're white? You tell me what this shit means." So I give him the best advice ever, you know. I said, "Yeah, what can you lose? You know, what's your alternative? You know, either take it, you know, and become a star," and like they did. Yeah, they did.
So that's kind of like the end of the, you know, sort of first chapter of your life here, where you had your band, your Motown band, but things didn't all pan out, and you ended back up in Vancouver. And your music career kind of ground to somewhat of a halt.
Yeah.
And you started working at a club there, a burlesque club.
Yeah.
And that's kind of where your next phase of your career happened, because that's when, around that time, you met Cheech, back to Cheech.
Yeah.
Because he was evading the draft up in Canada, and he came... You were introduced to him.
He wasn't really in evading the draft. He was part of a secret army that was up there. In case the Viet Cong came in from Alaska, which, you know, it could have happened. So that's what he was doing. Very secret. Yeah.
So what was it like when you met Cheech? How did you guys sort of bond and, you know, feel that like this is going to be something you're going to do for the rest of your lives?
Well, I've always been around funny guys. Like I said about Bobby Taylor, very funny, you know. And that whole culture is all about being funny and being real. And so when I met Cheech, he just made me. Well, you know what really impressed me about Cheech is the first night he came to see the group that I had, City Works. I looked out and he walked in with one of the most beautiful women I've ever seen in my life, wearing a mink coat, full-length mink coat. I mean, he looked like Hollywood coming in the door. And I was very impressed because I always judge a man by his woman. You look at the woman, you go, oh, man, you must be, you're all right. You can hang. And so when I saw Cheech's girlfriend, I said, whoa, okay, he's hired. But it wasn't a matter of hiring anybody. It was a matter of, you know, acquiring somebody. And so Cheech joined up. And it was like, he was more of an understudy in the beginning. He was so young. And he sat and watched. I had another partner named Dave. And Dave was like one of the freak brothers.
I know what you're all thinking.
Yeah. In fact, that's where Dave's Not Here came from. Because when Cheech was outside knocking on the door, I kept saying, who is it? The only name he could think of was Dave.
Now we know. I guess we might as well go to the clip.
Could have been. Who is it?
It's me, Dave. Open up, man. I got the stuff.
Who is it?
It's me, Dave, man. Open up. I got the stuff.
Who?
It's Dave, man. Open up. I think the cops saw me come in here.
Who is it?
It's Dave, man. Will you open up? I got the stuff with me.
Who?
Dave, man. Open up.
Dave?
Yeah, Dave. Come on, man. Open up. I think the cops
Dave's
saw me.
Dave's not here.
No, man. I'm Dave, man. Hey, come on, man.
Who is it?
It's Dave, man. Will you open up? I got the stuff with
Who?
Me. Dave, man. Open up.
Dave?
Yeah, Dave.
Dave's not here.
No, man. I am Dave, man. Will you? Come on. Open up the door, will you? I got the stuff with me. I think the cops saw
Who
me.
Who is it?
Open up the door. It's Dave.
Who?
Dave. D-A-V-E. Will you open up the goddamn
Dave?
Door? Yeah, Dave.
Dave?
Right, man. Dave. Now, will you open up the door?
Dave's not here. Yeah. It's like a symphony.
It's kind of like the stoner who's on first. You know?
You can see the songwriting. It's like a song. Yeah. Yeah, it's fun. I love it. I can hear it all the time. It makes me laugh. The original was funnier, if you can believe that. When he was really trying to get in, I wouldn't let him in the door. And he came in the door. He was swearing, cussing. But anyway.
Well, these are all these albums that you had out starting in 71 on Lou Adler's Ode Records. And a famous one that everybody, I see somebody has it right there, the Big Bamboo cover. So, you know, for the crowd of the 70s who embraced you, is certainly one of the highlights was that particular album cover with the huge rolling paper in it. So what sticks out most in your mind about that period when you were recording all those albums and you started to sort of build a big following?
Well, we had two lives, kind of. We had our live show and then we had our recording life. They were separate, you know. Our live show had very little to do with what we were doing on recording. Like, we never started doing Dave until the reunion, you know. Before that, we had a whole different live show. But
you never did Dave's Not Here during that show?
No. We never did a lot of any of the records, Sister Mary Elephant, Basketball Jones. We never did any of that live. We just, we had a live show. Which we're doing now, you know, which we did in San Francisco. Because you can, when you're live, you can be high and no one gives a shit.
So after that period where you did all these albums and became, you know, one of the biggest comedy stars, didn't you win a Grammy Award for one of those albums?
Yep, won a Grammy.
Okay. I should know that. I should know which one. I kind of forgot.
And I got it.
Which
they
one
only
was it
gave
for?
Us one. They
which
only
one?
Gave us one. And I
which
got
album? Which one?
It was for Los Cochinos.
Okay.
It should have been for Big Bamboo, but the Academy is usually a year late, behind, you know. You know, when you should have won, you don't, then the next year you win because someone else should have won. You know, it's crazy.
So your next big breakthrough came in 1978 when Cheech and Chong became movie stars thanks to Up in Smoke,
yes,
which is regarded by many as the greatest stoner movie of all time.
Yes.
I think so.
I can't think of anything else that says it like Up in Smoke.
Let's play the clip.
I'm a machine, and I don't work for nobody but you. I'm just a love machine, and I don't work for nobody but you. Well, my temperature rise, and then I go for her thighs, and then I say, guacamole in my juice. Guacamole in my juice. Hijo de la chinga.
Is that a joint, man?
God damn, it looks like a quarter pounder, man. Led Zeppelin.
Hey, be careful with that shit, man.
Is it heavy stuff, man? Will it blow me away?
Put your seatbelt on, man. I'll tell you that much.
I've been smoking since I was born, man. I could smoke anything, man. You know, like I smoked that Michoacan, man, Acapulco Gold, man. I even smoked that tight stick, you know?
Tight stick?
Yeah, you know, that stuff is tied to a stick, you know?
Tight stick.
Yeah, that didn't even do nothing to me, man. I could probably smoke this whole machine.
All right, sorry about that, but you get the idea. Oh. Everybody's seen that 100 times. All right?
Yeah.
So you went on to make 6 movies with Cheech. Up in Smoke, obviously we saw here. Next movie, Nice Dreams. We have a bunch. Which is your favorites? Or your favorite? After Up in Smoke.
Probably Up in Smoke. Yeah. I mean, I love Still Smoking, the Amsterdam movie. We had a great time doing that one. And we did it for so cheap that we made a shitload of money.
There are always some really great cameos and short roles, like Richard Pryor is in that one.
Yeah. In that one?
Yeah, isn't still he? Smoking? Yeah, Still Smoking. Isn't he?
I think so. But you know, Still Smoking, we used Prince's song. First time in a movie was Delirious was in Still Smoking. Prince. First time Prince was in a movie.
A moment Delirious for Prince. A moment for smoking. Prince. Any thoughts on Prince while you just brought it up? Any thoughts about Prince as you just bring it up?
Yeah, the only thing I thought about, the Prince is dead, but the Queen lives on.
Okay, we'll edit that one out.
No, she's 90. The Queen, long live the Queen. But the Prince is dead.
After this great period of movie making, you did go through this split with Cheech. So what happened at that time? You said he was getting away from marijuana. He wanted to go another direction. What was the source of the reason for you guys going your separate ways during that time?
No, it was meant to be. You know, when you reach a certain point, you will split for one reason or another. You will split because there's a life. We did our lifespan, you know. No group stays together forever except the Stones. You know. But no, it was a natural time for us to split. Had we not split, I wouldn't be, you know, what I'm doing now. You know, I wouldn't have done stand-up. I wouldn't have done, jail time in jail. A lot of good things I wouldn't have done, you know. So the split up was good. There are differences, of course, you know. And it became, in a way, it became creative differences where, like, I just wanted to do it my way. And he didn't want to do it my way. So we don't do it.
All right, so you went on your own, and you toured a lot. You started to work with your wife, Shelby, in clubs. And by the end of the 90s, you were cast as Leo in that 70s show.
Yes.
Which brought you to a whole new audience.
Yeah. That's especially in Wisconsin.
Let's play that clip. Let's play that clip.
We are big in Wisconsin.
So do you like photos, man?
Yeah, man. Sure.
Okay, you got the job, man.
Just like that? You don't have to interview anybody else?
Nobody else showed up, man.
So what do I do here anyway?
Well, I don't expect a lot, man. Like, pretty much if the hut doesn't burn down, it's been a good day. And even if it burned down, man, it's cool because I got three or four more of these little huts somewhere. Hey, listen, if you see one of these huts, would you give me a call, man?
What's your recollection of that period doing that 70s show?
Well, the only one of the reasons I took it, I turned down a lot of television. I still turn it down. You know, if it looks like, if it's not going to be fun, I ain't going to do it. Don't need to do it. And but when they sent me a tape of that 70s show, I saw the little marijuana circle. And I thought, yeah, okay, I can do this. But weird, when I got there, nobody smokes. And none of them smoked. First day in the 70s show, I was like, shh. Finally, the Chicano cameraman said, hey, I got it. No, that 70s show was great. You know what I did? Because, you know, when you do a TV show, you're pretty much in prison again, you know. You're let out to eat and let out to, you know, change your clothes. And then you're led to the set. And then you're led back to your room. And, you know, so what I did, and when you go back to your room, you sit and watch television or read or something. But I went to school. I would sit in and watch them, you know, make the sitcom. I went to sitcom school. So I'd sit in the audience and just watch and study, like a pupil, you know, like a film student. So I took, it's very important that I learned that take advantage of the time you have, because we're not here for long.
Like you said, you know, when you started working on your own and, you know, going in another direction, one of the things you did was you started a pipe company, and that led to you ultimately getting arrested in the government's Operation Pipe Dreams, going back to 2003, and you were charged in your Chong Glass Company with illegal interstate sales. So it's a long story, but, you know, I'm going to go into all the details, but suffice to say you pled guilty, spent 9 months, you know, in a federal correctional institution. So we talked about this for a minute, but how did that impact your life? Obviously in a major way, but how do you look at it now as to what that did to you?
It was like graduate school, you know. I was working toward a degree in street. And in order to complete it, I had to do 9 months in federal lockup. And I did it. I loved it. Loved it. I turned it into a religious retreat. I did. Because you can join any religion. They encourage you to join, you know, get into some kind of religion. And they had the Sweat Lodge Society of the Lakota Sioux, because the natives had sued the federal government to be able to worship their God the way they'd done for centuries. And so the government had to go along with it. So every federal prison in America has a sweat lodge, or at least they will make a sweat lodge if you need one. And the sweat lodge is great. It's a lodge. And what you do, you heat up a lot of rocks, you put it in the center of the lodge, like a sauna. And then you sit around and you sweat. That's why they call it a sweat lodge. But it's the way it's a religious thing is that the natives feel that the sweat lodge itself, the entrance, is like going into a womb.
you're going into a giant pussy, I guess. And once you're inside, you kind of cuddle around till you all facing the center. And you're usually stripped down, or in fact, most of the time, you're either naked or stripped down to your shorts, bathing suit. And before you go in, they smudge you with some kind of smoke. I forget what it is, but sage, thank you. And you get smoked out, and then you go inside, and they put the hot rocks. They bring the rocks in, and they talk to the rocks. They bring them with antlers, deer antlers, and they hold on. And the red hot rocks, and they call them grandfather. Grandfather rock, we'll put you over here, and oh, you look really nice. There you go. And, oops. You heard it too?
Yeah.
Okay.
I didn't hear a thing.
I got hearing aids, and sometimes the shit picks up weird things, you know. But anyway, I had a good time in the sweat lodge. I won't.
Okay, but you know, came out of jail, and you have been working tirelessly to reform the marijuana laws ever since. You know, what happened in jail that kind of transformed you? I mean, this experience.
There's a writer, his name is Joel S. Goldsmith. His books have inspired me and changed my life, starting somewhere in the 70s. I had a very, very, very spiritual experience. I was walking down the street, next thing I know, I'm turning into a publishing house, and next thing I know, I'm over at this bookstand, and all of a sudden I felt something push me down, and my arm went out, and I got a hold of the biography of Joel S. Goldsmith. And I took it home, and he's a spiritual mystic, that Jewish guy that really became a Christian Scientist, and then he became Joel Goldsmith. He never wrote anything. He would channel. And he would dictate, they would record his voices as he talked, and then these became books. And the books formed my total philosophy, which is what I believe in now. You know, that's why I believe with proof that marijuana is a gift from God. Marijuana is the burning bush that spoke to Moses in the Bible. And the bush appeared and called Moses, said, come here, Mo, come over here. Mo, you, yeah, here. This bud's for Jews.
That's a very appropriate comment on the Jewish Passover.
Everybody... Is anybody who's a Jew. Jews, the best writers in the world. They wrote the best book in the world, the Bible. Jewish writers, man. Make up shit. Though.
I'll take that as a compliment. All right, so let's move to the present. 4 states have legalized marijuana. Several more are likely to do so in November. Hint, California. Cannabis is legal in some form in now 40 states. Pennsylvania just passed medical marijuana. The climate has changed dramatically since 2003. Now you have your own brand of marijuana, Chong's Choice, and a number of other business ventures and sponsorships. So what do you think of what's now being called the Green Rush?
I think it's the greatest thing that ever happened to America, to the world. Isn't it funny that we're all being awoken by a plant that puts you to sleep? Think about that. That's what's happening.
That's a great one-liner. I love it. So you're among a number of celebrities who are getting into the Green Rush, Snoop Dogg and Woody Harrelson and B-Real and Whoopi Goldberg and Wiz Khalifa, and the list goes on of celebrities that are getting involved with cannabis products. And you have your line, which you're here, at the in the expo room, to show off Chong's Choice. So tell us about how you go about choosing your strains and where are they currently available?
Well, I think they're available wherever you can get them, I guess. That's the way I found it anyway. And it's Chong's Choice because I personally test, or at least I try to personally test every strain, every product that I have on the market. I like to say I put my own stamp on it, you know. Or I put my own match to it. That's what it is. No, I'm tireless. When I get into things like that, especially testing pot, you know, that's my main job. And then I'm surrounded by people that know how to sell it and package it and grow it and, you know, do all that.
So you have a vaporizer as well?
Yeah, I think we got everything. You know?
Yeah.
We got grinders. We got it.
Chong's Choice available in Oregon yet?
I think so.
Anybody stocking it?
I think that's why we're here.
Oh, yeah? Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I got some.
Yeah, you sure do.
All right.
That's a
meet
present.
Me afterwards.
That's a present.
All right, we're going to have a nice Chong's Choice party. Okay, so we're going to wrap it up, and we're going to turn a little political for a minute. The Oregon presidential primary is on May 17th, and the California primary is on June 7th. So recently, you came out in support of Bernie Sanders.
Yeah.
For the Democratic presidential nomination. You said he's the OG Kush at the top of the harvest and calls them the commander in Kush. So we're going to play this clip and then you're going to tell us, you know, when you start to feel the burn.
Okay.
To plant a garden is to believe in tomorrow. Smells fresh. The political season is starting to heat up. The sun's coming out and all our plants are beginning to bud. Do you smell that excitement? That's the polling places opening all around the country. It's time to vote, folks. So the question is, which one of these plants are ready for harvest? Some are obviously too immature. They need a couple of more growth cycles. And yet, others are done, finished. There's nothing left in them. They've lost all their potency, which they never had much of anyway. But there's one candidate that stands head and shoulders above them all, who has weathered many storms and is totally ready to be the commander-in-chief, or the commander-in-cush, as I like to say. Only one candidate this year that has said things I truly believe in, like supporting the legalization of a fair and humane immigration policy, something that Donald the Wall Trump would never support. The legalization of a real living wage. The legalization of equality for all. You get my point. Oh, and yes, Bernie does support that other form of legalization that I care so deeply about. The legalization of the super medicine, marijuana. So I know this year, you and I are gonna feel the burn. Go up to the polling booths and light up, man, for progress and change. See you soon, America. We got to do what's right, man. I'm Tommy Chong, and I approve this message.
Yeah, Bernie's got all the goods, man. It's going to be interesting what happens, because whatever happens, we're going to see it. Nice. And they can't hide it. They can't pretend it's something else. It's going to happen. Yeah. Anyway, Cheech and I, we did a bit last night about Cheech is upset about Trump, you know, because Trump wants to build a wall and wants Mexico to pay for it. So Cheech kind of took it personally. And so he started talking about it, and I said, he didn't say, no, I like Trump, man. He wants to build a mall. And Cheech said, no, he didn't, man. He said a wall. I said, no, fuck it. He said a mall.
Only an idiot would want to build a wall. He's a businessman. He's not stupid. Build a mall. That way, when people are coming across the border, they can stop and buy all the shit they need to make it the rest of the way, you know. Either way, we can go down to Mexico, too. I think it's quid pro quo, you know. If they can sneak up here, we should be able to go down there. That's the only thing. I said, open the borders, you know, make them free. Save a lot of money.
All right. Well, let's hope Bernie can win Oregon and maybe get all the way through the nomination. We'll see what he can do. If Bernie doesn't win the nomination, can you in good conscience support Hillary?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. In a minute. In a heartbeat. Man, you need a woman running this shit. That's how things get done. Put a woman in charge, man. Because, you know, they can focus on shit, you know. Men are horrible, man. They get distracted in a minute, man. Especially looks and smells good, you know.
You know, I think it's time to have some questions. Is Ngayo around?
Ngayo's right here. Let's hear it again for Steve Bloom and Tommy Chong. Who's got a question? Anyone have a question for there? We'll go right here.
This is pretty basic, but Tommy Chong, what's your favorite strain?
My favorite strain, I guess OG Kush. Yeah. But basically, I like anything given to me by a naked woman.
Fair enough.
You too, huh?
Or
man. Whatever.
Mr. Chong, I have a two-part question over here. Do you dab? And if so, do you want to after the show?
No, actually, I'm past my dab age. I don't dare try it. I don't dare try anything at this age, man. Be careful. Well, be careful anyway, but no, I don't dab. But thanks for the invite. I'm quite sure someone will take you up on it.
I'm sure you've, as an actor and entrepreneur for many years, have done many travels all over the world over. What have been some of your favorite countries to visit, some of your favorite destinations to go see, found a lot of interesting people, where you met a lot of interesting people, or, yeah.
Tommy?
He wants to know where you like to travel.
Oh, where do I like to travel? Yeah. I was tripping on you, man. I was trying to figure out what you're trying to say. And then what you mean. I just tripped off, man. But what was the question?
Where'd you like to travel? Where are cool places to travel for a stoner?
Everywhere, man. Shit.
Do you carry weed with you when you go, or do you just expect people to have some for you because you're Tommy?
It depends if I remember. I bring it. I don't know. It depends on what clothes I'm wearing at the time, I guess. Usually you reach in your pocket, oh, shit. But now you don't have to worry about it. Go through the airport, man. They stop Cheech all the time. He's got a sleeping apparatus. What's that? Poor Cheech. He hates being searched. And they just pat the shit out of you. Oh. I don't mind, man. I don't mind being searched. I got used to it in jail. You get used to it, man. After a while, it doesn't bother you to drop your pants, bend over, and spread your cheeks, you know? Feels good, actually. You know? Get a little air in there. It's not bad.
Hi. I was reading this Wikipedia page on you, and I just got to ask you about something regarding Four Inns and a Sea.
Is that
true?
Yeah, that's very true. Bobby Taylor and the Vancouvers. We never had a name. And the reason we were called Bobby Taylor and the Vancouvers, Motown put it down. Bobby Taylor
in the band from Vancouver. That was on the thing, and so they just changed it to Bobby Taylor and the Vancouvers. So we were trying to think of a name for the group. And at the time, there was a group in Texas called 10 Screaming Niggers. Mm-hmm. And so we got inspired. So we called ourselves Four Niggers and a Chink. Put it up on the marquee in Vancouver. It got international press. But it didn't help our crowd at all. No one was rushing down to see Four Niggers and a Chink. In fact, they stayed away, man. They didn't want to go to that party. Except one black ex-wrestler dancer named Lottie the Body. Lottie the Body came down, and we're playing. She was the only one in the audience. And she goes, after we stopped playing a tune, she looks at us. She goes, well, I see the niggers, but which one's the chink? And my dad, who was Chinese, he was half asleep. He's the doorman, and he woke up at that word, and he walked over to her, and he was going to give her a lecture. And she picked him up and body slammed him. And I'm on stage to see my dad getting body slammed. I throw my guitar down, I run down, and she grabs me, body slams me. And the rest of the band standing up on stage laughing their ass off. And finally, my brother came over and, put her in a chokehold and saved my life, basically. But that's the story of the Four Niggers and a Chink. After that, we changed the name to Four Colored Guys and a Chinese Lad.
Hey, Tommy, this is David. I was wondering how you feel about the cannabis in Oregon.
How do I feel about I don't feel the same about cannabis in any state. Oregon's beautiful. I love Oregon. It's beautiful, but when you're really stoned, oh, shit, it's too beautiful then.
All right, one last question. Here we go.
Right, I forgot. So I wanted to know what you'd support in this industry. What are we missing exactly?
What are we missing in this industry? I don't know. I'm not missing anything, I'll tell you that. My life is so beautiful. I wake up with a grin no matter what, man. Look what I got forward to. Look what I have to look forward to. My wife. So beautiful, she once was voted in the top 20 most beautiful women in the world, over 40 actually. Yeah, More Magazine. And she didn't tell me about it. She sent her picture in, next thing you know, she won. She was in the top 10. And she was on the Oprah show. And it was kind of mixed feeling, because the next day I was heading for Pittsburgh to be sentenced to jail. And so that day before, we're at Oprah, and Shelby's on stage with Oprah, and Oprah's holding her hand and telling her how beautiful she is, and it was a beautiful moment. And Oprah saw me, and it was like, nah, we better not talk right now. And so we passed each other in the night, and then the next day I went to get sentenced, got sentenced to jail, but it was a beautiful Shelby moment.
Just before we wrap it up, one of the things I didn't ask and I had at the front end that I decided to wait till the end, how are you doing? You have battled cancer, and how are things going for you?
Well, I'm here, ain't I?
I know you are. But tell us a little bit how you did it.
If I wasn't feeling good, I wouldn't be here.
What's the secret to your success of beating cancer now you're in your second time going around? You're not done, but, because it takes a while to be cancer-free, but still.
It's a Goldsmith's books. They have all the answers, Just check them out. I couldn't even begin to tell you. The only thing I can tell you is that You know, we all have a duty to ourselves to be the best you that you can be. Don't settle for less. Be the best. And that's all of us, regardless of what we're doing or what we're going through. Because that's what I learned. I'm laying, recovering from a very serious operation where they changed the plumbing. And I was laying there, and all I could do was smile because I was so blessed. Because I'm in a country with doctors and help and the best professional minds and the best weed in the world. And I'm laying there, and I was so happy, so blessed. I got miserable as soon as the shit starts wearing off, you know. And then all of a sudden, it, like, shit gets real serious, ain't it, you know. And that little dope button they give you, all of a sudden you're banging that motherfucker. But it was a pot that saved my life. And it can save, it's saving our lives, everything. And on every aspect, every level, you know. The main All right. thing, the main thing about pot, though, is that I found, it makes you more loving. And that's all we need.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Tommy Chong, who, by the way, will be 78 years old next month. So let's think about Tommy when he has that great birthday. I want to thank everybody here at the Oregon Medical Business Conference, Alex Rogers, the whole gang, awesome people, terrific event, and keep coming back, and we'll see you next in Vancouver.
That's right. Steve Bloom, everybody. Tommy Chong, everybody. Don't forget, after party tonight at the WOW Hall, at 8 p.m., and it's your last chance to get a cheap $300 ticket for Vancouver, which will be October. All right. Thank you very much for coming to the Oregon Marijuana Business Conference. We will see you tonight, and we will see you in Vancouver. Peace.